All right, welcome to another episode of the Sons of History podcast, and I will say happy Columbus Day and happy birthday to me, because this episode is coming out October 9th, and me and old Chris, I was born on, I guess technically, Columbus Day. Hey, Alan.
What's up?
Yeah, thank you for the birthday wishes. So, ladies and gentlemen, we are going to get right into the thick of things.
I do not recall you giving me a birthday wish.
Because you don't announce it. In fact, your birthday falls during the summer months, and we don't have a show during the summer.
That's not an excuse. If you really cared, you'd find a way.
You know, I don't think that's true, because I can't even remember what my mother's birthday is. And I have a hard time every single year. I always forget my mom's birthday, my dad's birthday.
Are you kidding me? I knew my parents' birthdays.
Huh?
I knew my parents' birthdays.
Yes, well, you're
so
a good
you,
son.
So for you to not remember, man, that's...
It's not good, and I acknowledge that. I acknowledge it. So I try to make it up in other ways of trying to live an upstanding life to honor my parents, unlike you, who lives like a tramp, who lives in debauchery. Anyways, happy Columbus Day, everyone. Happy birthday to me again, since it's not coming from the other side over there. If you haven't yet, subscribe to us wherever you're listening. And we're on YouTube. You can leave us a like, comment, subscribe, click the bell. You'll get alerts. If you're listening on the podcast, interestingly enough, you can subscribe and then leave us a 5-star rating, which would be wonderful. Very kind of you. You're the best around. Nobody's going to knock you down. And you can leave us a review, and somebody left us a review, and we're actually going to address that review right here. Somebody by the name of, well, it's Kirk NX. He left, wish you would provide a list somewhere of sources we could go to read about the ancient history of the different empires that you recently mentioned on your September 25th podcast. That was last week, that we were talking about sources and, you know, where to go. And Alan, you are set, ready to go to discuss those things. Now you are, after a little bit of a mishap earlier, but go ahead. Take it away, Doctor.
All right, Doctor. Well, and I do want to wish you a warm and hearty happy birthday. So.
Shut up. Don't want to hear it.
All right. Your obligatory birthday. Okay. So, the request was regarding ancient sources. So, you know, there are plenty of books that you can find right now on written today about the ancient times. But if you want to go back a ways, and I would say, like, one of the more recent one would be is it Edward Gibbon's The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire.
I was going to say that one.
But that's, you know, that was written what in the 18th century. So, but if you want to go back a ways, okay, Plutarch is one of the best sources that you can get. He's famous for writing the lives, and he compares the Greek lives with the Roman lives. So, you know, famous Greek people and Roman people. So this is a good source to go to if you want to know what life was like back in the day. Now, you can't call yourself a historian or a history lover if you have not read Herodotus, and specifically his work, The Histories. Would you agree, Doctor?
I'll agree to that.
You know, listen.
It's a lot.
It's got a lot of information, like how the Persian Empire came about and, you know, the rise of the Persian Empire. And then, you know, if you like the movie 300 and its sequel, 300, Rise of an Empire, if you like the story of, if you like to run marathons, well, how the marathon came about. That's all in Herodotus' book, The Histories. And there's also a lot of information on Egyptian history in there. So you got to read Herodotus. You got to get through it. I know there's going to be some parts where you're ready to just, you know, all right, give me something to wake up. But if you can get through it, I think you're great.
Yeah.
Now, some of these names I'm going to butcher, okay? So I'm going to call them by whatever names come to mind. It's either Thucydides or Thucydides. I've heard both. I think Thucydides is more the Greek version, I think. Thucydides, he wrote the Peloponnesian War, the history of the Peloponnesian War. That was a fought between the Spartans and the Athenians. Actually, everybody else in between.
Pick a Thebes. Side.
Yeah, I mean, everybody, it was a huge war, and it lasted, what, 27 years?
Yeah, with, during a time of supposed peace, right?
Yep. Now, you know, Thucydides did not live long enough to finish his work. He died before he finished writing about the entire war. So there was a guy named Xenophon who took up where he left off. And Xenophon wrote a couple of famous books, not just that one. He wrote he wrote the remainder of the war, including the conclusion of the war. And then he went on and talked about what went on in Greece afterwards. So he's a good source if you want to read a good adventure story about the Greek mercenaries that fought in Persia. Polybius. Now, Polybius was, he wrote about the Roman Empire. So did a man named Livy. Livy wrote, there's about four condensed works that you can get on him. Cassius or Cassius Dio, he's written several works. Suetonius. Then you have Flavius Josephus. Now, Josephus supposedly witnessed the destruction of Jerusalem. So if you want to read about what went on in Judah and Israel back in during the Roman Empire, Josephus is a good person to read. Also, I wanted to mention this one here. It's called The Code of Hammurabi. He was a king of Babylon. A very good source. You know, much of some of the early laws that he wrote were very similar to what Moses, Moses during his time in Israel, or prior to Israel forming, rather. A lot of the laws are the same. Did I mention Sallust?
You didn't mention him yet, no.
I didn't mention Sallust. Okay, so there's Sallust. There is Tacitus. There's Pliny the Younger. Pliny the Younger was the one who witnessed... what was going on? What was that volcano? Was it Etna or Vesuvius? Or which one was the one that wiped out?
Right?
Vesuvius, God, I can't even remember.
That was it.
Was it Vesuvius?
Mount Vesuvius. Isn't that how you say it? Madison, is that
you know,
how you say it?
I've got all these facts bunched up in my head. Sometimes they get all cluttered up.
Yeah, my dog's not helping me.
Anyway, Pliny the Younger witnessed the volcano that destroyed Pompeii. And now there was a guy named Pliny the Elder. They were related. Pliny the Elder, he wrote a lot of works, and he was actually killed when the volcano blew up and wiped out Pompeii. Julius Caesar, he wrote a couple of books himself. He wrote a book on his war in Gaul and then the civil war that he fought. Arrian. Okay, so this is Arrian. Now, Arrian wrote about Alexander the Great and his conquests in Africa and in Asia, destroying the Persian Empire. So Arrian is a wonderful source. There's also a couple of other people who wrote about him, about Alexander the Great. Boy, man, you're really going to have to edit this one, dude.
No, I'm not editing any of this.
Okay.
Oh,
you're going to edit this part?
Nope, I'm not editing any of
it. Oh, yes, you are.
I'll just bleep that out.
All right.
Just get through it. Like this, we want the sources. Like, look, we're going to have a condensed list in the comment section of our YouTube channel and on the podcast. So it'll be in the notes.
All right. So some of the other people. Okay. So there's Quintus of Smyrna. There's Diodorus Siculus. There's Herodian. There's Ammianus Marcellinus. There's Quintus Curtius Rufus. Now, he also wrote about Alexander the Great. There's Procopius, Justinian, Lucan, Appian, Aristotle, Plato, and Marcus Aurelius. And there's a whole lot more. If you go to the Loeb Library, they've got a whole bunch of them. Herodian, you know, the green ones are supposed to be on Greece, and then you have the red books that are more on the Roman Empire. You have Jerome, somebody that you should read about, Tertullian, Boethius, all there. The reds are Roman, the green are Greek, and they do have the corresponding original language right there if you know how to read Greek or want to learn how to read Greek. Oh, man, right. That was...
That's it. Thanks. All right, ladies and gentlemen, we hope that you enjoyed the show.
Okay.
Kirk, sorry, man.
Sorry to have to put you through that, but yeah, you know.
Hey, you gotta be careful what you wish for, right?
Yeah.
you ask Alan anything, and he's going to take you. He is the history's version of Common Core math. He is the long way around. Yeah.
Are you suggesting I'm long-winded?
Yeah, just a little bit. All right. We're going to be talking about war. We're going to be talking about war today, and specifically sort of how war has changed. And we're going to start in our modern era, and it's primarily going to be in regard to the U.S. The U.S., how we have addressed wars and over our close to 250-year period. We're going to actually work backwards. We're going to start with your second half of the 20th century into the 21st century, which we've sort of labeled unwilling wars. These are wars that start, and yet we either are unwilling to finish them or are incapable of finishing them. You've got a list of, I would love for you to go through your list here, but I'm going to go through them myself, and then we can pick apart some of them. But you've mentioned one, Korea. This is the war that, you know, we were first involved in after World War II, and then you've got the Bay of Pigs, and then followed up with the Cuban Missile Crisis, and then obviously you've got Vietnam, Cambodia, and Laos, Lebanon, Libya, 86 to 2012, and then you've got Somalia. You've got a friend who was involved in the Battle of Mogadishu, who I think you are still, 3 years in trying to get him on the show. Good luck with that. Yugoslavia.
I wouldn't have had whiskey with him.
Don't care about what you're saying. Bosnia, Croatia, and Serbia, and then following up again in Yugoslavia between Kosovo and Serbia. The thing about these battles, man, when you look at these battles, what are some of the things that you say we did right, we did wrong, and why we didn't finish them?
Well, it depends on who you're talking to, but I mean,
I'm talking to you. I just asked you the freaking question. Like, who else am I talking to? Madison's over here. She's asleep. I just woke her up.
Listen.
Look, man.
Let's talk Korea, okay? Let's talk Korea.
Yeah.
And then and there's a reason why I said what I said, because you have some people like MacArthur that was saying that in Korea we should have nuked China, Red China. Okay? But you had other side who said no, that was a war that we should have fought to the 50-yard line, because that's where it started and that's where we needed to go. So that's why I'm saying it depends on who you're talking to. MacArthur couldn't believe that we were fighting to the 50-yard line. He was like, you always go for the touchdown. Why are we fighting to hold territory? We need to go in there and beat the hell out of Red China so that they don't come back and bother us again for another 100 years.
Yeah. And the thing is we went from 50-yard line to about our 5-yard line all the way to their 5-yard line, and then back to the 50-yard line, and it comes down to Chinese involvement, right? I mean, it was a close run thing.
Yeah, we would have conquered the whole country had it not been for Red China.
Correct, and obviously North Korea would have taken the whole country if we hadn't gotten fully involved. It was very close both ways, but yes, it comes down to, at the very end, you have 300,000 plus Chinese sent through the Yalu River. And now you're in a situation where, one, you're already breaking records as far as artillery usage. You have bombed the crap out of North Korea to the point where they're incapable of more or less agricultural production for however long, right? I mean, that plays a role in that country moving forward. Even in South Korea, it was so terrible that MacArthur said it'll be 100 years before this country gets back on its feet. And so he called, you know, the development of South Korea an absolute miracle, rightly so. But then it comes down to, you've introduced the world into the nuclear age with World War II. And this is 8 years later, right? And then you have the threat of nuclear warfare again. But it's like, over what? It's not so much over Korea, it's over ideology. And that's where pretty much all of our 20th century wars, post, you know, the second half of the 20th century, these wars are fought. They're not so much fought over typical things like land. They're fought over ideologies. It's
yeah, but I mean, just about all wars have been fought over ideology to some extent, or maybe not all, but quite a few are fought over ideology.
I mean, yes, I mean that you could say that, but it's like, which ones?
Over ideology?
Yeah.
The religious wars. The 30 Years War, the 30 Years War was over ideology. You had the Protestants versus the Catholics. The French Wars of Religion, same thing.
The
100 Years War, that was
yeah,
that was
the
French
War
king.
Is more like more of land, right? I mean, you've
yeah,
got
well, the 100 Years War was.
Correct.
The Hundred Years War was for land. That was because he had King Edward III of England wanting to expand his territory into what he thought was rightfully his. France was like, screw you.
And you think of like, well, you just went through ancient empire sources, right? A vast majority of those is strictly about conquering lands, expanding
correct.
your economic hold, your economic prosperity.
Although the war between the Spartans and the Athenians was kind of an ideological war also, because they both looked at things in a different manner, and Athens wanted to be the big, you know, the big brother, follow us, we're going to be the big man, and Sparta was more, you know, they you know, if you look at the blue states versus the red states, or blue cities versus red areas, Athens was a lot like what you see with New York, and they looked down upon the Spartans and some of the other locations, and were demanding that you pay us tribute, and we'll take care of you and whatnot.
Would you say that that is along the lines, and I don't want to get way off topic, but would you say that that's along the lines of ideology, or just we want to be in power, like we want to be in control?
You have to remember that the Spartans were a warrior people. The Athenians were not. The Athenians, they were into democracy. They were into philosophy.
I'll concede that it's maybe, I guess you could say it's ideology between the Spartans and the Athenians. But I would see it more of hegemony. That's what I would view it as. Like, we want to bring everybody under, like, we want to quote unquote federalize Greece. Like, we want to be, Athens wants to be the Washington DC, right? Of Greece and the Greek Isles. But anyways, I don't want to get too caught up in the weeds there, but I guess you could say maybe like a 50-50 thing on ideology, because we could talk about Franco-Prussian War. Obviously, that was about land. Even World War I, that was about land and empire. World War II, a lot of that was, obviously, you had ideologues in power, but a lot of those excuses was, hey, we want to take some of the land back that we lost.
So the Spanish Civil War was...
that was ideologically driven, for sure.
That was ideological.
Yeah.
So was the French Revolution.
Yeah, the French Revolution was a civil war, though. I would say the Napoleonic Wars were not a war of ideology. That was a war of empire.
That was a war of empire. But the fighting between, you know, the different factions.
Right, that's like the Russian Civil War. Same thing, right? It's like you're having a. I think the lines sort of blur a little bit with the American Civil War, which we'll get into. But you have an unwillingness to take the steps during Korea. I mean, and then you're hit. I think Korea and Vietnam are great examples of, yes, we could win this war immediately. But what would that result in? And I think the idea of victory and what that requires in the modern sense is in itself a deterrent to pursue victory.
Oh, okay.
I mean, do you agree with that or no?
You know, Vietnam, North Vietnam wanted to conquer South Vietnam so that the entire country, the entire peninsula would be under communist control. They didn't try to take over when, you know, Cambodia was taken over by the Khmer Rouge. Laos was taken over. But, and yes, in North Vietnam wanted hegemony over Cambodia because their ideological differences were apparent. The Khmer Rouge were Maoists. The North Vietnamese were Marxists. So...
And oddly enough, you would rather have had the North Vietnamese take over than the Cambodians.
Correct, correct. Now, if you look at, let's say, the Middle East wars, you know, the Palestinians and the Israelis are Semitic people. They're from the same, you know, lineage of Noah, but they have religious differences. They have ideological differences that are embedded in their religion. So... You know, when you had all the different wars of the Middle East, all the Arab-Israeli wars, you know, they were ideological wars. They're ideological and religious wars. They were kind of woven in together. I think if you're going to win a war, I am having trouble embracing the whole idea of being timid when it comes to winning a war. You can go in there and raise hell and just destroy your enemy. You know, the Soviet Union did that in 56 when they went into Hungary. And they dared anybody to stop us. We could have done that in Korea. We could have done that in Vietnam, but we didn't. The Soviets did the same thing in Czechoslovakia about, 12 years later.
But the thing is, the difference between the Hungarian Revolution that got squashed and the war in Korea was... Nobody responded to the Soviet Union. Nobody responded and said, you're not going to do this. The Chinese, however, did respond and said, no, you're going to be pushed back beyond the 38th parallel. They did respond. So there was a difference, right? So I think to an extent, maybe if it would had been on our borders, let's say that Hungary, instead of it being Hungary, is actually Mexico, right? And the Mexicans have a revolution against the Soviet Union. And the Soviet Union comes in and says, you're not going to do this. And they come and crush the Mexican Revolution. Well, that's on our border, right? And now we're like, oh boy. So I think land, again, has something to do with that. It's like if you jumped in with that conflict with the Soviet Union during the Hungarian Revolution... You're asking for something that you're not apparently willing to do. And that is take it up a notch from raising hell to bringing hell on earth. The Chinese were willing to do it. And I think I think one of the differences is that the reason the Chinese were willing to do it is because they obviously did not care about how many people that they lost. Mao and the Communist Party didn't really care about losing hundreds of thousands of soldiers or people in general. That's why, like, the famines were to him, like, not that big of a deal. I mean, let me rephrase. The famine was a big deal. The loss of millions of people were not a big deal. So I think throwing people to the slaughter is not a big deal to the Chinese Communist Party back then, probably even today. For America, big difference.
Okay. The things that MacArthur was saying was, you know, let's destroy the bridges, even if they're on the Chinese side. You know, that movie, the movie Bridges of Tokori is, you know, it's a fictionalized story about those bridges. But, you know, we didn't go all out and remove the bridges that, that brought in the supplies. We were afraid to bomb China. Well, screw them, you know, they were killing our men. They were fighting our men. They were killing, the Chosen Reservoir, you know. We're at war with them. We should have just bombed the hell out of Red China. Well, I don't know why we didn't. MacArthur couldn't understand why we didn't. We're already in a war with them. Okay, so what if it escalated? China really did not have the means to take the war to our shores. They didn't have any chance of invasion. That's why, you know, that's part of the reason why they never invaded Taiwan to this day, is because they don't have the logistics to invade Taiwan.
Yeah, but
They might now.
I agree with that. Like, the Chinese did not have the capability to stand toe-to-toe with us. Not at all. But this was before the little schism between China and the Soviet Union.
Mm-hmm. Well, we tried to play nice with Red China. We're still dealing with them to this day. We're still dealing with North Korea to this day. We should have finished the job. I know, God, it sucks, but we're still having to deal with it to this day.
What I'm saying. It's like, dude, your technology, your nuclear technology, even without nuclear technology, like the technology that you have militarily is just so devastating that's what I'm saying. It's like your ultimate achievement is annihilation. And maybe that is where we need to get to in order to not have any more wars, you know, and to be like,
well, look. I mean, we didn't have to annihilate China. We just had to knock them out of the war. Because you really can't invade Red China.
What if China would have turned it into a Vietnam? Where it's like, it's an infinite war. Like, hey, we're just going to keep coming. We've got 1 billion people and we'll send them all.
Okay, well, they didn't really have much technology at that time. You got to remember, Mao took over in 1949.
Mm-hmm.
And then a year later, he sends troops to fight us. Okay. China had been our ally up until he took over.
Right.
So that civil war destroyed quite a bit of their infrastructure. I mean, they had from 37 until 45, they were fighting the Japanese. And then from 45 to 49, you had the civil war. China just did not have much of an infrastructure. They did not have much industry. You know, their weapons, I don't know the history of their weaponry, but I would imagine, I know that the Soviet Union gave them a shitload of weapons that the Japanese surrendered when they gave up Manchuria. I do know that. And that's what happens when you become friends with the communists. Now, if I realize the ramifications of having an all-out total war with China, which can be avoided, the key would be knock them out of the war. Japan did that to Russia in 1905. They knocked Russia out of the war without having to march into Moscow or St. Petersburg.
Yeah.
So it can be done. You don't have to totally annihilate. You know, when we went to war with Britain in 1775 as well as in 1812, our goal was not to march into London. Okay, we knew we weren't going to invade London, but we wanted to knock them out of North America, at least in the War of 1812. Same thing when we went to war with Spain. We weren't going to go marching into Spain to conquer the country. We wanted to knock them out of the war in the Philippines and in Cuba, and we did. The same thing could have been done where we won the war. Now, what's going to happen after that? I don't know, but what I could tell you is that there wouldn't be a North Korea had we finished the job. Same thing with the Bay of Pigs. Kennedy didn't want to, he was literally scared to show any American weaponry or show any American involvement with the Bay of Pigs. Everybody knew that the United States was involved. Everybody knew. There's no way that they could have done it without our assistance. But he fell down on the job. It was a failure. It was an embarrassment to the United States. We had to, you know, pay ransom for those Cuban freedom fighters. And then the following year, we almost went to war with the Soviet Union with the Cuban Missile Crisis.
See, my and I think this is the primary concern. The primary concern is collateral damage. You're not going to go in the Cuban Missile Crisis or the Bay of Pigs and say, look, communism is out. We're gonna knock you out. We're not going to go when China intervenes in the Korean War. We're not going to go in and be like, okay, we're knocking you out of the war, because it's like, okay, where are you knocking them out, right? It's like, this is the collateral damages. You got to wipe out almost everybody.
Yeah, well, Grenada. We went into Grenada. Grenada is no longer a threat. Granted, it's a little island, but still.
Well, I mean, Cuba would be the same thing as well, right? It's like, what are you willing to do? You had the Soviet Union, and I guess it goes back to what Patton says, like, hey, we got to go after the Soviet Union next, because the problems that they're going to cause are going to be perpetual and massive, right? And so they did for the next 50 years. Well, China, same way. Like, if we would have knocked them out when we had the chance, then we wouldn't be having these problems now. Now, people, and I'm sort of on the same side, is like, dude, but what you have to do in order to get there, in order to get to that victory, is so horrific that is it worth doing? I don't want to say as a humanitarian, but for humanity, like, is that really worth doing? And I guess, like, let's say 10 years from now, 20 years from now, and somehow we become a vassal state of China. Somehow they've gotten so great and so big that they took over America, and now we are under their subjection. Obviously, we're going to look at that and say, well, had 60 years ago, we actually would have done what MacArthur was saying, we wouldn't be in this situation, because hindsight's 20/20. My thing is, we live in a time where you can't win wars anymore. I just don't think that you can. And I think Afghanistan is picture perfect. Like, if you want to go in and bomb the whole place, that's what you'll have to do in order to win. Because you're facing a totally different animal nowadays. And it goes back to the whole ideology. I think ideology is the primary culprit in half of the 20th century. Moving forward, it's like we're dealing with now almost strictly ideology and religions. And so good luck going in there and winning a war. It's like everything shows you, like,
I'll agree with you to some extent, but you can win wars without fighting them yourselves. You know, right now our country's being overrun by Venezuelans, and I'm pretty disappointed in them. I am disappointed in the Venezuelans right now. Why are they coming here? If your country is that bad, if your government is that bad, get rid of them. Don't come here. Stay there and fight and overthrow your government. Okay? That is what you do. It's what the Nicaraguans did it. You know, when we had the Contra Wars. Now, yeah, granted, Daniel Ortega is back. I was going to say Somoza, not Somoza. Daniel Ortega is back. The Islamists are going to win the War of the Crusades because they have invaded Europe. They're going to slowly take over Europe. France is going to slowly become an Islamic nation. It's going to maybe be a couple of generations, but it is going to happen. The United States, I don't know. I think we're done. I think we've gone beyond the point where we have so many people in this country right now. You know, our economic system is going to collapse, and that's how you can destroy a country. That's how you win a war. Our economic system, we're going to have so many people vying for fewer jobs that, you know, we're going to have a big separation between the upper class and the lower class. We're not going to have much of a middle class. They are going to be trying to take up so much room, so many buildings, so many homes that, you know, housing costs are going to go up. Wages are going to go down. That's how you do it. They did a good job. The people who wanted to wreck this country, they did a good job. They've done it. They've brought in so many people that our schools are not going to be able to handle them. Our hospitals are not going to be able to handle them.
And who would you say, when you say they, who would you say is the culprit? Would you say it's the former Soviets? Would you say it's the modern Chinese? Would you say it's, I mean, I think it is ideologically driven.
Who was that guy that we interviewed a while back? Was it Michael Walsh?
I don't know. We interviewed a lot of people.
I think his name was Michael Walsh. What he stated was that when we got rid of the communist nations in the late 80s and early 90s, the seeds were thrown up into the air and they grew in places like the New World, the United States. Okay. You know, capitalism now is a dirty word. Western civilization is a dirty word. So who did it? Your George Soros's? I'm going to say it. Yeah, the Democrat Party. The Democrat Party. They opened the borders and left it open. And I think today finally they said, "Hey, you know what?
We need to build a wall."
What's that?
Yeah, they need to do something about it. But that's only because the northern states are now complaining about it, primarily.
Yeah, the city. Yeah, New York. Chicago, New York are saying this is unsustainable. LA is saying this is unsustainable. We can't do this. But they're in here now, and they have kids, and their kids are going to need to go to school because the Supreme Court says you have to educate them.
Here's the thing. I would love to have like a mute button every once in a while, just so that we can remain on topic, because it seems to be an impossibility.
You can't defeat, or you said you can't defeat a country or invade a country or something like that. I will agree with you to some extent, but you don't need to now. You don't need to. You can send in some people with a virus. Send some people with a highly contagious virus, and
Alan,
spread it around.
That's exactly my point then.
I'm not disagreeing with you. I'm not disagreeing with what you're
saying.
I
didn't say that we didn't have the capability to do
okay.
it. I said we didn't have the will to do it. Like, you can't win a war anymore because one has the will to do it.
I agree with you.
And probably for a good reason. Probably it's good that we don't have, and I think I'm repeating myself, I think it is good that we don't have the will to win wars anymore, because how we have advanced through nuclear warfare to germ warfare to biological warfare, like, it has gotten to the point where war is not war of the previous however many thousands of years, and we can go back to the ancient empires. It's no longer that. It's no longer where you have the Assyrians coming up and besieging a walled city for 6 months. And starving people out to the point where they capitulate and say, okay, we give up. It's no longer that. We've gotten to the point where we will say, not only will we wipe out your country, but the collateral damage you just said, you know, spread a disease. Like, the collateral damage could be, we're going to wipe out half or, you know, a large portion of the globe. Like, victory for that. It's like, that's not worth pursuing victory. That's not. And that's why I think things have changed from your World War II and prior, especially for America. You had a war, you had wars that you pursued that you said, this is the goal. We are going to go, and we're not going to end until we win. And we can go back to the Mexican-American War, where we're like, hey, we're going to beat these people and we're going to, you know, sign a treaty and get half, more than half of their land, right? Well, we're going to go into the Civil War. We're going to fight each other and we're not going until we burn Atlanta to the ground. And this is what I'm saying. It's like Spanish America. You said, we're not going to Spain. We're not going to Spain. Of course, we're not going to Spain because we knew that we had the capability to defeat them pretty quickly and free Cuba or whatever you want to call it. World War One. Everybody, like, that's when the game started to change. World War One. This is what I think. I think the game really started to change with World War One, the whole war to end all wars, because everybody's like, man, this war is so bad that war itself has now, victory itself has now become a deterrent to war. Like, nobody wants to be involved in this. Like, we have talked about with World War One, like, everybody's rejoicing in the streets, and it's like, yeah, go get them, go get them, you know, for the French, and for the Germans, and for the Belgians, and for the, you know, British. It's like, everybody was excited, and then all of a sudden, you realize, oh, my God, like, the technology has advanced so much in the previous 10 to 20 years that we had no idea that we were not just, you know, got a gunshot wound. No, these are people who are being blown to mist.
Well, you
and
had,
then you move
you
into
had airplane.
World War
you,
II.
Yeah, World War One. You had airplanes. You had submarines. Yeah, it was a, you know, when
and then it just
some
got
the,
worse in World War II. It's like,
well, when the European nations were fighting, let's say some of the other countries, maybe like some of the colonial wars, they had what's that saying about Britain has the Maxim gun? Britain had the machine gun. Their enemies did not. But in World War One, both sides had the machine gun. And, you know, that's how you ended up with the trench warfare. The French didn't even want to fight trench warfare at the beginning. They're like, get off our land type of thing. And they kept throwing in all their young men, and those young men were just getting wiped out. But, yeah, the machine gun, you had poison gas. You had the Zeppelins bombing London. You had the airplane machine gunning, submarine warfare. All that was, that had never at this scale.
I think that's sort of the idea. I think that's where we're going, and it sort of ties in what we're talking about with the ideology, where it's the war between the battle of thoughts, the battle of beliefs, and I think. We are almost to the point, unless AI totally changes warfare over again, to where you're not even dealing with people fighting, you're dealing with machines fighting and technology fighting against each other, computers. But let's say that that's not the case. Then I think what you said about, you don't need to go in and invade. You can have a disease spread, but I think ideologically you can have a mind disease, a mind illness spread through a country to kill it, or at least to kill what it was and turn it into something else, like say what communist China wants or what the former Soviet Union wanted.
Like TikTok.
Because yes, like you're doing it through other means now, because one, the ones that you are attacking, let's say America, you're attacking America, and America says, we've got the latest and the greatest of aircraft, submarines, ships, anything and everything. Artillery, the best guns, everything. We've got the best soldiers. We've got the best of everything. But we've got, here's the thing, it's like, you've got the best of everything, but it doesn't really mean anything if you're not willing to use it. And the real issue is you can't use it if you have no idea who to use it on. And so now you've taken the military aspect out of warfare. And now you've moved it into ideological warfare. And it's like, well, hopefully we can just hang on. Hopefully we can educate the next generation, which we're doing a piss poor job of. Hopefully we can educate the next couple of generations to hold on against this incoming sense of warfare, this like you said, like it's a disease, but it's a mind disease. It's an ideological disease that gets into the mind and says everything that this country stood for, you could say any country, but let's say America, what this country stood for is wrong. Let's reverse it. And then we kill ourselves. I think that that's where warfare is sort of going, because warfare of history is no longer sustainable. It's no longer usable.
I agree. Wars nowadays, like, you know, yes, you can conquer somebody, but you don't have to send in an army. You can send in millions and millions of migrants. You can send millions and millions of migrants into a country to crush an economy.
Yeah.
To crush the society, to change the society of people who don't necessarily celebrate the, Western civilization. You know, we use the English law. We look at the, we're a Judeo-Christian society.
I agree. I think it's culture.
If you throw in millions and millions of people with a different demographic, where the languages are different, the religions are different, you don't have
cohesion.
Yes, thank you. You know, one of the reasons why the United States defeated Mexico so easily was because the American people had one mind, but the Mexicans were tribal. They were all different tribes, and they weren't necessarily going to. You know, you had a lot of Mexicans that helped out the Americans to attack Mexico City and capture Mexico City because they didn't care for the government. There was no cohesion. And that's where we are now. That's where we are today. If a foreign country invades us, let's say that a foreign country invades us, you know, I would not be surprised if there's a lot of people, say, from California who sits there and provides aid and comfort to our enemies. I mean, they do not like our economic system. They do not like our history. But you don't need, what I'm saying is that you can infiltrate. You can I think they call it the fifth column. You can infiltrate the country with the migrants. You can infiltrate with diseases, someone having a disease. You can use EMPs. You can use viruses. You know, Israel can wipe out the Iranian nuclear program with viruses, computer viruses.
Yeah.
You know, I heard a story where we helped blow up a pipeline in the Soviet Union with a computer virus back in the days when it was back in the 80s.
Yeah, I mean, that's where warfare is. And I think, oddly enough, because America often gets compared to the Roman Empire, and there's always this, and you mentioned Edward Gibbon at the very beginning of the decline and fall of the Roman Empire. And I think that's always been sort of the great question in over the past 2,000 years. And that is, how did Rome fall? And obviously it's not one particular thing, but I think probably the greatest part of the fall of the Roman Empire was the complete change of culture. Culture on various aspects. Culture from the perspective of the Romans were really the Romans from like Rome were no longer fighting their own wars. Everybody was so caught up in their luxury and comfort that it changed the dynamic of what it meant to be a citizen. The corruption, obviously, in the government, but government and corruption go hand in hand. It's just like, how can you keep it from getting too out of hand? But I also think that one of the main things, and you and I are both Christians, but I think one of the main things that caused the collapse of the Roman Empire was the culture shift, the immediate culture shift from believing in the Roman gods and moving into Christianity. It changed the whole mindset from top to bottom of that country. And if you have, and this, you can pinpoint almost any country that collapses, and in a lot of ways you can pinpoint, was there a culture shift, and what happened when there was that culture shift. So I think that we're experiencing that right now.
Yeah, they hate our they hate our economic system. They hate, they're turning away from religion. They're ashamed of America's history.
And what's odd is and this is why that there's that culture shift, is because in a lot of ways this is not those that are coming into the country. Like this are not first year people, right? Or first generation people. A lot of these people that are anti-American are multi-generational Americans. And a lot of them are these like young white kids that like to yell and scream on college campuses. It's like, dude, you're doing everybody a real disservice.
And I wanted to point something out that, you know, when I sit here and I, you know, say negative things about the Democrat Party, this is not me saying vote Republican. That's not what that is. I don't want to get that impression. I'm not here to talk about how great the Republican Party is. The Republican Party has its problems, where sometimes they're not looking. They're turning their backs while some of these things are taking place. And, you know, like allowing this invasion of our country, allowing the destruction of the middle class. They're not doing their part. So there's a lot of blame that can go around. So I didn't want our audience to sit and think that this is me going rah, rah, Republican Party. That's not, but right now, could we win a war? If we went to war with anybody, I just don't see it happening. I do not see it. I don't see us going to war with China. I don't see us, you know, I know there'll be a lot of people, oh yeah, Russia, we hate the Russians.
Well, you've demoralized the people, and a demoralized people will not go to bat for their country. They're not going to lay their lives on the line for their country. And that's what I'm saying. Like, to an extent, a lot of this feels really purposeful. Let's demoralize the nation in numerous aspects. The one, like, you think of all the institutions, we're going to wrap up here in a couple of minutes, but you think of all the institutions that we no longer trust. American institutions, leading institutions, like leading, like the global like aspect of institutions, from media to medical to educational to
FBI.
Governmental to, yeah, to just like all of these institutions have failed and have made no bones about it and have made zero apologies for it. And that's where you're like, well, what are we fighting for? That's a scary question to have asked by your citizens.
Yeah, I don't trust the FBI, the Department of Justice. Some of the stuff I'm hearing about the CIA. And hell, I tried to work for the CIA right after 9/11. So, you know, even the Bush family, I totally lost respect for that family. I totally supported them back in the day, but not anymore. It is demoralizing, because look where we are. When you're not all gung ho, and you're, you know, I'm gung ho about the Constitution. I'm gung ho about the American way of life. But they did their job, and they did it well. And yep. Here we are.
And here we are.
And here we are. And we're now a nation that probably I don't know who we could defeat. I mean, could we defeat Russia if it was strictly military, one on one? Yeah, we could. But Russia and China, you know, what's going to happen if China invades Taiwan? And that's something that we really do have to sit and think about, because if they do invade Taiwan, we have a decision to make. Are we going to help Taiwan, who's our friend? Are we going to, and if we choose not to fight, then no country in the world is going to trust us. And you're going to see shifting alliances. You'll have countries that, I mean, look what's happened to, say, Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia has shifted. They were getting highly involved with the United States, but now they're working with Iran. They just signed a peace deal with Iran, with China. So I mean, you really have to sit and think about shifting the possibility of shifting alliances. If we, we've already allowed Afghanistan to fall. If Ukraine falls and if Taiwan falls, we'll have no credibility left.
Yeah. Bad stuff, man. Bad stuff. But guess we'll just see what happens. Empires rise, empires fall. All right, man. I think that is it.
Are you sure?
Well, it's going to be it. How about that?
Are you sure you don't want to talk up? No, never mind. I'm not going to bring up anymore.
That's the thing, man. Giving you slack to take the line.
You know,
sometimes maybe I should kill
have
this guy.
My own TV series on the Epoch Times, where we just talk about books. We talk about historians, philosophers.
Yeah, you do that. All right, well, ladies and gentlemen, that is it for the show. See you later, Alan.
See you later, Dustin. Have fun wherever you're going.
That's right. I'll be leaving.
You're doing your little project.
Yep. I'll see y'all later. Have a good one.